I'm reminded of an early recollection of Hoffman. I suppose when I was about eight, I was in the shop and he was there with his green baize apron. And at the back, I don't know whether you remember, Jim, he had these tapes which tied it together, which were very long.
Yeah.
And I, rather mischievously, came up behind him and I tugged at these tapes. And he turned around to me, his spectacles on the tip of his nose. He says, "The Tales of Hoffman." My father was there at the time. He roared with laughter, but I didn't, of course, understand what he was talking about. Yeah. And of course, it's the Barcarolle, the famous.
Yeah.
Remember that tune?
Yeah.
You want to play it?
There's a picture in the big room inside of August Wilhelmy. August Wilhelmy went into Meinl's in London to have Willie's father sent to Dublin to look after Adolf, who was August's son. His son was coming to teach in the academy, and August Wilhelmy wanted Willie's father there to look after his instruments. So Willie's father arrived the 15th of August 1906. In sentimental terms, which Eastern Europeans are, it was a lashing wet day, supposed to be our summer, and it was the poor man's birthday into the bargain, and he felt miserable and he said, "I'll give it a year," in his own mind. And he got himself a workshop across the road from Westland Row Station so that work could be sent from Meinl's in London to keep him working in Dublin. And this would arrive on a Monday morning and was posted back on Saturday. And the new box arrived on the following Monday morning. And that kept Willie's father going for the first few years till things got established. Then that continued till the 1418 war. And Charlie Meinl was sent over to Dublin to keep the shop going while Willie's father was interned, because he was German and we were under British rule at that stage. And he was there until 1918. And he came back to work in the shop as Meinl's. And a few years later, Willie's father was made a partner. In that time, old Mr. Hoffman worked all the time on his own. And he had a marvellous business going. He had all the convents around the country, and the ledgers, the old ledgers there, there's not a town in Ireland that had a convent that wasn't one of his clients.
Well, I remember Willie's dad, Mr. Hoffman, in Lincoln Place. And when I was about 5 years of age, my aunt brought me in to get my first violin there. And I was overawed with the collection of instruments hanging up in these lovely display cabinets. I'd never seen anything quite like it in my whole life. And Mr. Hoffman, I remember, a bald man with steel-rimmed glasses and this green apron, and he would come out, man a few words. I don't know had he much English at the time, but I probably didn't utter a word at that age. And he would take down a couple of violins and he'd measure you by your arm and that kind of thing. And I remember getting my first one there, and then maybe 2 years later I needed to move to a slightly bigger one. And you'd arrive and he would measure you again, and he would, you'd be looking forward to your next instrument. And then he might say, we need to wait for another 3, 4, 5 months or whatever before you would move on to the next one. And you would be really disappointed. But he was a lovely man.
I don't think I was ever privileged with being brought in to have an instrument. I probably got one handed down somewhere along the way. But I had been in the shop quite often. You'd be amazed, stand in awe, looking at the instruments hanging on the wall and Willie's dad then working away.
Before the war, Willie and his mother and father used to pack up a big trunk and off they'd go for a month. They did that every second year, from the time he was a very small child until the year before the war broke out. And then, of course, when the war broke out, there was no going back. And after the war, when Germany was divided, he couldn't go back because his family were on the east side. And that Willie and I went over when the wall came down, and we had the opportunity because Willie was a member of the Entente de Luthier, violin makers and bow makers. And he was asked, did he have any instruments that his father had made, because his father was from Auchnacurshan, that he had made after he had left a home. So Willie had a few, and he was asked, would he put one in to this exhibition? So I said to Willie, why don't we go? And it was a wonderful experience. And I can remember the day we were walking up the shady side of the street to get out of the sun. And Willie said, my grandmother's house is up here if we turn right. And there's a bass maker living in that house now, or there was then. That's a few years back. But he was very pleased to see it. But he wouldn't let me knock on the door because Willie had had to sign away his part ownership of that house when under communist rule, because they had put people into the house. And his two cousins, who lived in Switzerland at that stage, two elderly ladies, they had to do the same. And that's so that broke the connection.
I played the fiddle as a youngster in the School of Music, and my father brought me to Willie's workshop to get a new E string. And I out in Sydenham Road in Balls Bridge, and I met Willie there for the first time when I was, I suppose, about 10 or 11 years old. And then I asked him for an apprenticeship when I was... I liked the setup and I liked fiddles, and I was a very, very badly failed fiddle player even at the age of 11. And I asked him for an apprenticeship then when I was about 14, when I was in secondary school, and I was refused. He told me to go back and do my leaving cert. I suppose I didn't want to do anything else as much as anything else. I wanted to make instruments, and so I applied for an apprenticeship to a harp maker and to a guitar maker and then to an organ builder as well as Willie. But I kept coming back to fiddles, and eventually he pointed me in the direction of a college to go and learn, after I'd done my leaving certificate, to study violin making in a college in Cork. And that's how I got into it. So then after, when I came back from Cork, I did outwork for Willie for several years. I had a workshop in Dunleary, and I did a lot of work for Willie on his instruments, on customers' instruments, on big repairs that he just simply didn't have time to do. And that was really when my training with Willie, so to speak, happened, that I did so much work that had to be repeated and gone over and got right, that I think that was a good fundamental training in how to set up a fiddle and how to smooth the fingerboard and cut a neck to a nice shape and make pegs work and do the basics that are required of setting up old fiddles.
On the music scene in Dublin, if we go back to my school days, it was very, very active. My father would be playing in the theatre Monday to Saturday. Sunday night was off, but people would gather in each other's houses and you might have a session of chamber music and Beethoven and Bach and so on. So the music scene was extremely strong. There were amateur orchestras around, like the Dublin Orchestral Players and so on. And then later stage came along the Radio Erden orchestras. So the scene was very, very active indeed.
The orchestras of the 20s and 30s are remembered by Dermot Murnaghan.
You know, I was 17.
17,
yeah. But, it was through the picture houses. Mr. Schofield played, and my mother was one of the first pianists in Dublin in the cinemas.
In one of the picture houses.
Yes, and that's where I met Mr. Schofield. I'd just sit beside him and fill his pipe and turn over for him and all that. And
well, it'd be nice to hear what the music sounded like at some stage. You know, there were huge parts, weren't they?
We used to play ridiculous. You played Beethoven's Fifth Symphony on a trio and done that. Ridiculous, really.
Well, that was in the days of the silent pictures.
Yes. I finished up in the Grand Central. I was the last cellist in the Grand Central with J.J. Farrell. And then, as you know, I was the last in the Abbey Theatre here, I was the last in the Olympia, and I was the last in the Gate.
Well, so the talkies, of course, put the cinemas out of business, but they didn't put the Abbey out of business.
It was at the end of the Abbey I was there, Winnie Rankin left us. Yeah. I did the last year there.
Yeah. What about the cafe orchestras?
I played in Wynn's Hotel and Frascati's, that was in Suffolk Street. I played there with May Young. Very pleasant times there. It was all light music, the same as the picture house.
Well, the sort of Metzler trio. Did you use a trio or
a trio most of the time?
Piano, fiddle, cello. So,
because Lang used to play the fiddle in Wynn's. Mm-hmm. That was Carmel Lang's mother.
Night time when he'd be finished his job, Willie would he played in the theatre orchestras. He was in the Gaiety, he was in the Royal, he was in the Olympia, and he played the double bass, I think, in most of them. I think he was in the Capitol as well. He started on the violin and he changed to the viola. And the viola was the love of his life. And then the double bass.
I don't know an awful lot about his being a musician, except that it was a part of his life that he obviously really enjoyed. It had various fringe benefits as well, in that he always had a tuxedo in his workshop, which meant that he was always available to go dancing, which he loved. And women apparently would frequently pop into the workshop and ask him would he go to the Gresham that night because they didn't have a partner. So he always had a clean tux, which was very useful in that respect. But he preferred playing the bass, I think, in general. Our bass players were better paid because they had to stand up in the pit and had to be seen. So they always had to have a laundered collar. So they were given a daily allowance to have their collar laundered. But the downside of that was that they couldn't nip out for a pint during the rests, particularly important when they were playing the Gaiety, because he used to talk about popping out for a pint at the rests in the Gaiety and popping out to Neary's for a pint and then running back in again. Somebody would be set to tell them when they were back on, and they'd rush back in again and start playing again. So if you were the double bass player, you were stuck because you couldn't go. And one time they came back and found the double bass player had died, wrapped around his double bass, standing there in the pit, which Willie thought was hilarious. He lost a customer, but it was worth it.
We shall now take the case of James Phelan Plummer versus Mrs. Mulligan Widow for breach of promise. Call the plaintiff.
Mrs. Mulligan.
Ah, but where would you see a fine woman like me? Billy Mulligan, the pride of the coop. Me boys, Billy Mulligan, the pride of the coop.
Oh, silence, woman, silence. Quiet, please.
Ah, how are you, Jones? Put it there. It's a long time since I've seen you. You're looking smashing. Did you get over your operation?
Be quiet, please.
I'm only talking to this gent here. Pardon yourself.
All the time while he was violin making, it was difficult, I think, for Willie, because he came to an age when he should have been training properly, just after the Second World War. And Germany, where his grandmother on his father's side was of the Glasel family, and they were a very big violin-making family. They had factories. They produced a lot of those trade fiddles that you see. And Willie was supposed to go and serve his time to Glasel, or to one of the Glasels, to that workshop. And his father decided that Germany was no place for a youngster in 1947 and held him back. And so Willie never actually got a formal training in Germany, which would have been very useful for him to have got away from underneath the family roof, if you like, and to have got other eyes looking at his work. But Willie had a very good training with his father, as good really as most any workshop in the world at the time.
Well, I had the greatest trust in Willie. I mean, I have a lovely Hill violin that my father bought for me when I was about 15 years of age, and I have it to this day, and my daughter plays it, and it's the most beautiful instrument. If Willie had to do any repairs or anything, small cracks or anything like that, he would take the belly off a violin and you would have it in two pieces. And if anybody came in that didn't know very much about instruments and they came in and they saw the violin in two parts, they'd say, "My goodness, that's in bits." But really that was quite normal, because you had to open it like that to repair cracks from the inside at times, and it would all be put back together good as new. So that was never a major problem. But I would have the greatest faith in Willie. He could do absolutely anything, because, I mean, you had to trust somebody, because string players and a lot of violinists, we wouldn't really know very much about repairs at all. So we had to entrust everything to Willie, and hopefully it would get back and sound the same as it had before he opened it up, and which it always did, of course.
It's a very personal relationship, really, you know, and you think that you're the most important person, you know, and you're the only one going along, but everybody else is in the same position, you know. But he always treated you as if you were the only person, you know.
At one stage, Willie told me a story about my father, which I hadn't known, that every Holy Week, my father would appear at the shop with this cello, which was in for its annual overhaul, smoothing down of the fingerboard to repair all the wear and tear on it during the year. Now, the reason for this was very, very simple, that this was the only week in the year that the theatres were shut. So the cello did actually have to go on its annual retreat.
He did enjoy his work. In fact, when we got married at first, he explained to me we wouldn't be able to take long holidays. We couldn't go for longer than a week because he missed the feeling of the wood in his fingers. And after, when I left the bank and I took up furniture restoration, I got to have an idea of what he meant, because I can stroke wood now and feel the different layers in it. You know, it's just that sensitivity in the fingers. But gradually he learned to extend the holidays to 10 days and nearly a fortnight. But that's the way it just was.
Oh, I well remember that Willie always had a great eye for an instrument, and he came across a violin which needed a lot of work and he thought had great potential. When he told his dad about this, his dad had no interest whatever in this violin. So Willie, unbeknownst to the dad, actually did a restoration job on it. And years later, the dad came across it and was enthusiastic about it and sort of asked Willie, where did this come from? And Willie told him, well, actually, that was the fiddle that you weren't interested in and I fixed up. But it's interesting because Willie was very proud of his father, and one of his treasured possessions was a cello which his dad had made and Willie had got. And he really loved this cello and wouldn't part with it for anything.
I first started playing the cello after my grandfather had passed away, and I was 12 when I started playing, so I was big enough to play on a full-size cello. So the first cello I ever played was my grandfather's cello, which would have been well known to the Hoffmans. Well, I can't remember a time when I didn't know Willie or Mr. Hoffman as I always knew him as, really. Because I met him when I was terribly young, and then when I started playing the cello, it was just a relationship that evolved out. And certainly in the last few years, I would have regarded him as a good friend, as kind of an uncle figure, who was always wonderful to talk to about instruments and any musical problems, but also about everything under the sun. He was great, witty, terrific, terrific man to talk to.
I suppose it's a very nice thing to see a workshop that has tools in it that could have been used by a fiddle maker 300 years ago. And when Willie's father moved to Dublin, they stocked the workshop with tools from a catalogue. I actually have a copy in a book, I found a copy of the catalogue with the entire set of tools in it. And Willie used those tools all the time, right up until when he died. And I used those tools, of course, when I worked with Willie. And there was a great, not to be over-romantic about it, but there's a great feeling from old tools, particularly tools that have worked all their lives. They haven't been resurrected. They from a junk shop, you know. They're lovely tools. And so there was that feeling of an old workshop, first of all. And I suppose Willie had his own working ways. Now, when he was in Sydenham Road, there were fiddles absolutely everywhere. I mean, it was a 5-bedroom house and 3 of the bedrooms were full of fiddles. And the bathroom was full of fiddles. And they had a board over the bath on which they kept 5 cellos. You know, it was that the amount of instruments there was astonishing. So the amount of dust and fiddles lying around was always fantastic to a fiddle maker. When you were interested in fiddles, it was like going into an Aladdin's cave of tools and fiddles. He loved Irish fiddles. He loved old Irish fiddles. He had a great collection of old Irish fiddles, some of the very nicest ones that I'd ever seen. He had two fantastic Perry fiddles, a red one and a yellow one. Not the little kind of brown square-shouldered Perrys that most of them are, but these were Amati pattern fiddles and they were very, very nice. And then he had a couple of Macintosh fiddles that were lovely. And he also had, well, he had all sorts. He had Guyton fiddles from Cork and a Guyton viola, which is a lovely, lovely viola. And he had an amazing collection of broken up old English and Irish fiddles that were just beyond repair, or in those days, certainly beyond repair, and nowadays largely of no great use, except as examples of the maker's work. He loved those instruments and he knew an awful lot about them. an extraordinary amount about them. He, in fact, Willie was very, very, very knowledgeable by any standards about fiddles. He really knew a lot about fiddles. He really did know quite a lot about instruments, and he loved them. He particularly loved Irish fiddles.
I remember the Girl Guides one year did HMS Pinafore in the Archbishop Byrne Hall, and Willie was playing the viola and I was playing the cello, and Noreen O'Neill was the other cello. Well, she was the lead cello. I was the number two, three, four, whatever. And in the middle of something, my D string, whang, broke. And I looked at Noreen and I looked at Willie, and shifted in the positions, carried on. And at the interval, Willie's dad came up and said to Willie, fix her cello, fix the string. So he tied a knot in it. Lucky enough, there was enough string to tie a knot in it so as I could carry on, because I wasn't all that efficient, because I wasn't that long playing the cello. So that got me over the hump. We lost touch with each other, and then we met up again and lost touch. And we were fortunate enough to meet up again in the spring of 1977. And we got married in the November. Well, I mean, we knew each other.
Yeah.
And we could always sort of start a conversation in the middle. Like, I remember meeting him in 1977. And I looked at him and said, I like the beard. And I hadn't seen him for years at that stage. Ah, he said, I got lazy and couldn't be bothered shaving. And that, well, I said, it's nicely trimmed and groomed and that, you know. And it was that easy relationship. You know, it was great being friends. And that, and we had a great time. And we managed, despite his awful illness, we achieved 25 years.
This is one of the instruments. How many did your father make when he was here?
About 18.
About 18. And this was the first. When was the last made?
In 1940.
Uh-huh. Do you know where they are, at the, any of them are at the moment? Or
I know where most of them are.
Most of them are. You keep a record as to who has them.
I try to keep a line on them all.
I know.
I know that the last one is somewhere in the north of Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And last time I saw it was in pieces.
It was being repaired, was it?
No, it just
got broken.
It just got damp and it fell into pieces.
He made one and he was so disgusted with what he did that he said, no, it's not for me, I'll do the repairs. And left it at that. But his father and his uncles made fiddles. In fact, his uncle Philip made a lot of fiddles and they were posted over to him. Because there, you'll still get a Philip Hoffman violin somewhere around Dublin.
This fiddle, it was made by Philip Hoffman probably in the 40s and 50s. You can see the brand mark there, that's Philip Hoffman. These were imported, Willie's father brought these in from his brother, unlabelled. And I think some of them were varnished in Ireland, but I'm not sure about that. And there were two grades. There were the number ones and number twos. And the number ones were spirit varnished and the number twos were oil varnished, and this is one of the oil varnished fiddles, which would have been quite a lot more expensive than the spirit varnished fiddles. Yeah, and as I say, these things were brought in unlabelled because at the time, I think there was some sort of law against selling articles made by members of your family abroad, and there was also a law about selling anything that could be produced in Ireland after the war. You know, there was, in an effort to support home industries, they banned the import of anything that could be made in the country. So these were brought in unlabeled as trade fiddles and then labeled in Ireland, and there were boxes of labels there and they were just stuck in by Willie's father.
Didn't see him for a great number of years, even though I always knew of him. I actually met him over my mother's house a few times, a couple of times maybe, in the 25 or 30 years that's missing. My daughter then, who plays the violin and I suppose wanted to get into various other areas of music, was looking for an electric violin. And she didn't particularly like the ones that were available off the shelf. So she asked me, would I not make one? And I said, well, the only person that can tell me anything about making electric violins, or even violins for that matter, would be Willie. So I went out to him in his workshop, which was at that time in Greystones. And I told him what I was thinking of doing, and he looked at me over his glasses and under his glasses and sideways out of his glasses and got out a piece of paper, probably a cigarette packet or something like that, and wrote down a few measurements, and he just handed it to me and told me to go home and make it myself. So I did. And he got pleasantly interested then in what I was doing and the alternative materials that I was using, and I suppose really he found it exhilarating to be, I suppose, maybe being asked to get into this. Not that he was into it, but certainly anything that I asked him about violin making, he supplied me with the information. Well, I suppose really what Willie thought of was similar to what I thought, like that it was important to play all sorts of music, especially if it was what you wanted to play, not what other people wanted to play or listen to. So he, you know, I wouldn't say that he'd sit down and listen to Pink Floyd now or some of those, but, you know, he understood like that there was music there for everybody.
Willie always took out a subscription to the Fesh Ciol. And when he lived in Sydenham Road, and even when he was in Lincoln Place, and he tried to do it when we were down here in Kilbeddar, he went up to the Fesh, because the way he looked at it was, it was to see the next generation of musicians. He would be always there for the junior ones, then he'd be there for the senior ones to see how they were getting on. And the parents of the children appreciated it, as well as the teachers. And of course the kids themselves were chuffed if Mr. Hoffman was there.
Willie was very interested in particularly, I remember him talking to me about children who had fantastic sound, you know, really the makings of a great sound, a good bow arm. And so he knew her, he knew children, and he had such a memory that he'd actually remember dozens and dozens and dozens of children and how they played and, you know, what they were like. And he was very interested in music in that respect, in that way. When Willie's father died, I think it was 1966, Willie moved. After that, he had actually bought the freehold of the shop, and he moved then to his home. At the time, I remember he was supposed to have semi-retired, but in fact he never retired at all. He just wanted to get away a little bit so that he had some time to himself. And he worked and lived then in Sydenham Road and Ballsbridge, and subsequently he moved down to Kilpeder in Wicklow when they sold Ballsbridge. I think that was 1987. I was at the time, I did serve a short time in the shop in London learning restoration. Willie approached me then to open a workshop together in Greystones, and we did that in the early 90s, and we continued until 1998. And then Willie more or less retired. You might say he semi-retired again, and he went back to his workshop in Kilpeder, and I moved down to my workshop. So that was his kind of, that was the run of the thing.
Well, I actually don't think Willie ever retired. I don't think so, because I used to go down to him from time to time, and for a man that was supposed to be retired, I'm sorry, I couldn't say that he ever retired.
Well, Willie might have tried, but I don't think the clients believed it. In fact, not until there was the grand finale, when a group of his clients got together and organised a proper retirement party in Merrion Square. That was wonderful, because even the people who had left the country, they were all there. It was a wonderful tribute, marvellous evening.
Yes, I saw Willie during his illness, and as it got worse and he was less able to get around, and that is very sad to see this happening, but he'd had a good life and he'd helped an awful lot of people, both professionals and amateurs in the music scene, so it was a very, very good life he had.
Over the last 10 years, I suppose, Willie began to slow down, and a life of dust and smoking had caught up in his lungs, and he'd been asthmatic from a very young age, so it became more and more difficult for him to work at all. And when he retired, over the last few years, his emphysema got worse, and he had bronchial asthma, I think, and eventually he died in May of this year, and he was 73. But for years he'd been slowing down so that he couldn't work anymore, and even when we worked in Greystones, I remember finding him standing outside in the bottom of the stairs, find it hard to get up the stairs, you know.
This was the workshop that Willie started up here in Way Cottage after we moved from Sydenham Road. And he brought his father's workbench, but got himself a new one. And that, in fact, that's the second one that's in here, because he was working here for a while and then Connor joined him when he came back from London. And they were both together in Greystones. And they were there, I think, for about 6 years. And it was after that then that Willie decided that he'd better retire. But in the meantime, Robert Pierce, the bow maker, has fallen in love with this bench and he wants to have it. So it will be still staying in Ireland, because it's going to Robert's house that he's preparing for his retirement. So I'm glad it's going to him, because he was a cellist in the orchestra and that's how his connection with Willie. So I'm glad this will be still staying with the vague Hoffman connection.
Oh gosh, Willie was a very important person. I mean, he looked after everybody in the whole of Ireland and all the convents. I think he had nearly all their instruments too. And people sort of looked on him and sort of felt confident that he was there, that they know they had somebody to go to, knew what they were talking about, you know. So he'll be sadly missed, really. You know, although at the same time, life goes on, we know, and there are young people coming on, probably, hopefully will take over, you know. But he will be missed as a person as well.
As Willie got older, and he'd be walking round with his oxygen cylinders on, I can see him in Greystones, and it must have been like what Uncle Michael was like in Cork, with the cap tilted on the Kildare side of his head, and the oxygen cylinders down in front, and his stick, and the angle. I mean, he used to cut a dash in Greystones.
It's true to say that he himself and his father kept generations of fiddle players on the road in Ireland. Literally on their own for years and years and years, virtually on their own. There were a few other people making and or repairing fiddles, but they kept generations. And the turnover of the business, I mean, not the turnover, money turnover, but the amount of fiddles that they brought in and did up and sold, at very affordable prices, really, was astonishing. It's astonishing to look at the stock books and see kind of 16 fiddles in 1 month brought in, refitted and sold. And that wouldn't be exceptional at all, you know. So he kept an awful lot. And they, you know, years ago they ran a hire purchase scheme where people could pay for their children's fiddles on a weekly basis, you know, a shilling a week or whatever. And they kept a ledger. And that's how a lot of fiddle players got their first fiddle, you know.
Well, first of all, he's a gentleman. And up to the very end, he had a fabulous sense of humour. Really, you know, I suppose I could tell you stories, but they wouldn't be suitable for the radio. But he had a great sense of humour, all the time, all the time. And would be always willing to listen to your sense of humour too. So that was where I enjoyed him. And I think he probably enjoyed me.